computer scientist, but clearly not a mathematician, so this will be rather light on equations, and I hope I won't get lynched in this audience by that. But basically, I'll talk about measuring changes in neuroanatomy, with really focusing on two methods, nonlinear registrations and basic deformation-based morphometry, as well as extracting the cortex and measuring cortical thickness. So as a first aside, why do we even care about anatomy, especially why do we care about subtle changes in anatomy? And there's lots of individual examples one can give, such as changes in Alzheimer's disease, where you have loss of memory and accompanying changes in anatomy as well. But an interesting study that came out recently came from the Mouse Imaging Center at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, where I'm at now, where since they started, they had 15 different mouse models coming from a random mutagenesis project. And these 15 different mouse models each had some behavioral deficits or another, whether it was spatial memory deficits or startle response deficits. And they all underwent some form of neuroimaging, whether it's just MR looking for changes in brain anatomy or looking for changes in the vasculature. And of the 15 different mouse models, where there was some behavioral abnormality based on just a single point mutation or one or two point mutations, 13 of them showed neuroimaging findings in terms of how the anatomy is changing. There seems to be a very strong relationship between the anatomy of the brain and behaviors. Ultimately, trying to find these subtle changes can tell us a lot about what behavior will be like, or how behavior can change, and potentially can be used as a predictive way of finding what is going on in a person, especially in the disease process. So the first that I will talk about, the first method, is deformation-based morphometry. And there's a whole series of image processing steps that we usually use in analyzing this data, and I'll talk about the way we do it in Montreal, but a lot of these methods are quite similar, whether it's done here at UCLA or whether it's done in different groups in the world. So I'm not claiming that this has all been invented by us and this is the only way of doing it. But the basic approach for the tensor-based morphometry, looking at the deformations, is you take your input MRI, you optionally correct it for non-uniformity artifacts, undergo linear registration, perform the deformations, and then look at the deformation fields themselves. So the first step is once you have your scan, and we usually do it on T1 MR scans in humans, but it can be anything, as long as you have good gray-white contrast and good image boundary contrast. So you have the data that comes out of the scanner, and usually this magnetic field in the scanner, the B0 field, is not perfectly homogeneous, which should be to give you an identical signal. For example, in this case, if you look at white matter and or gray matter in the top of the brain, it's definitely lighter than it is as you get towards the bottom. You try to find that non-uniformity field by using a spline approximation, trying to find any very smoothly changing levels of intensity across the brain. And you remove that in order to get an image where gray matter should have the same intensity no matter what part of the brain that you're in, or white matter should have the same intensity. Similarly, you try to normalize all of the brains for position. So this is either a 6, 9, or 12 parameter or 12 parameter transform where you line all the brains up in the same way. And we usually use 9 parameters, so we have 3 translations, 3 rotations, and 3 scales. So here's an example of just a bunch of T1 images, axial slices, as they come out of the scanner, and then after you perform this normalization. So basically at this point all the brains are in roughly the same space, but no distortion has happened to the brains at all except for the scaling factor. Once you have data at this point, we use a multi-resolution deformation technique in order to try to get the brains to look as identical as possible, or identical as we can. So basically, the way it works is that the images are initially blurred a bit. You superimpose a grid onto them, and then you start deforming this grid in order to have the brains, in order to match the intensity, sort of optimize the cross-correlation between brains. And then you redo this, you take this input from this transformer, you do it again in slightly less blurring with a slightly finer grid, until you have the converge to the closest thing to final solution of having two brains that look identical, or as much as you can get in humans, given that two brains will not ever look identical. And I'm sure Lu Cheng will recognize this picture, will have taken it from one of his papers. So once you have the deformations that have happened, once these grids have been realigned in order to make one brain look like the other, the key measure to look at is the Jacobian of the deformation matrix. So basically at each point, you can try to see whether the way that voxel or the way that grid point had to deform increase the size of that area encompassed by the grid point or decrease the size. And so in these cases, anything which is in blue shows where the mesh had to deform in such a way as that voxel had to shrink. Anything red is where it had to grow. If anything yellow is simply a non-volume changing deformation. And given these Jacobian matrices, then you have all of the images aligned across all the subarrays and try to see, is there a difference in how much this area of the brain had to deform to get to the final atlas, let's say between grooves. So one example is a simple study of musical training where we had kids from, this is data collected in Boston with Guthrie Schlug's group, where they started their study at 5 years of age. They were scanned once, and then about half the kids underwent intensive musical training, the other half did not. They were scanned again at age 7. and the brains from the H5 were deformed towards the H7 time point for each kid. And then we looked at every boxel to see if there's a difference in how much the brain had to deform, depending on whether they had this intensive musical training or not. And indeed they did. And the one point I'm just showing here is the difference in deformation magnitude in the motor part of the brain, which were the kids which had at least 5 hours of musical training a week in those 2 years, ended up having an increasing amount of growth in the motor part of the cortex. Now we use a similar set of methods for dealing with mice. In lots of ways this is a lot easier in mice, because the human brain is quite complex. Lots of foldings that are different from person to person, and the mouse brain is not. Which means deformations can be quite ideal, because you really can get an identical match between two mice that are genetically identical otherwise, or only have a simple mutation between them. So in this case, we get all the native MRIs, and this, we're doing this on a 7 Tesla scanner, and the scans tend to be T2 weighted scans. We then do a rigid body registration across all the mice in a particular study towards the pre-existing atlas. But once we have this first six parameter registration, we try to get away from anything which is model dependent and build a model independent atlas of the group. So we do a series of all pairwise 12 parameter registrations. And you just see one slice of the brain, including the hippocampus, dentate gyrus here, and the cerebellum, showing how well the brain, the average lines up. Hey, the more definition is an average, the better the alignment will be between the mice in the study. So we do a series of all pairwise 12 parameter registration between all the mice in the study. And for each mouse, we average all the transforms towards all the other mice. Then we sample the mice with that towards a 12 parameter space. At this point, you have shearing, scaling, rotation, and translation. And then we do a series of iterative nonlinear registrations, in this case, six generations. So what we do is we register all of the mice nonlinearly towards the target of the previous generation. So we start out by registering it towards the 12 parameter average. You then average all of the brains after this registration. You do it again towards that previous average, and so on, until after six generations. Each time you also decrease the amount of spacing between the grid points. We have a final atlas, which is as close to correspondence we can actually get in these mice. And given the amount of definition you can see in here, where you can see, really see the dentate gyrus clearly, all the sulci are almost identical, you really do get a very good alignment between all the mice. So just one way of studying this is we, in this case, labeled the, and barely see these images, anyway, look at the graph. We labeled the anterior commissure and the white matter of the parafloculus and the cerebellum on 5 different mice. Try to see how much overlap there was between these points as you went across these nonlinear generations. So basically, after just the 12 parameter average, you can see there's not that much overlap, especially of the anterior commissure and the cerebellum sulcus is out of the area. Basically, all these mice have to use a rigid body registration, not rigid body, 12 parameter registration between them. There's still going to be a bit of variance as to where each voxel is located for a particular structure. And then as you begin to go through the nonlinear generations, usually we stop at 6, this point here, you can see that the amount of overlap of that voxel, or of that structure, of the voxels labeled with that structure label, begins to increase considerably until it reaches a maximum. You can skip the cerebellum sulcus at around the 6th generation, and yet you can go slightly further in terms of always averaging again towards the previous atlas from the registration procedure for these mice. So ultimately we stop here. We have these mice in as close to the identical position as possible, which again with mice can be quite close. We then invert the transforms and look at the Jacobians as to what difference there is between voxel growth or shrinkage at each point in the brain. And this is the second measure that we use rather than just the Jacobians, also telling t-square statistic, where you can try to see the difference in movement between each voxel, looking at the deformation vectors. Now there's extremely little morphological variability in these mice. So what this map shows is just the amount of positional difference, mean positional difference, at every voxel, at every point in the brain. And this is the scale bar from 0 to 300 microns. So most of the brain, the actual positional difference, in this case this is in 20 male C57 mice, is around 50 or 60 micron between these mice. So again, you have genetically identical animals which had the same environment to grow up in, and then they do have almost identical brains. And there's some areas that seem to be some slightly increased variability, including in the cortex and in the parts of the cerebellum. And even that doesn't go up to about 200, 300 microns. Pardon?
How big are
they? How big are the brains?
About 20.
Yeah. So they're certainly quite a bit smaller than obviously. We're scanning them at 32 micron as a topic resolution. And these brains are actually not in vivo scans, but postmortem scans. So the specimen we're able to sit in ProHands, which is a gadolinium soaked solution, which gives us this increased contrast we can't really get with in vivo scans. So another example of what these deformation differences can look like is here we compared male and female mice. And again, C57 mice, they're all 12 weeks old. And this is just one example of the cerebellum where the two mice were averaged independently, and we outlined the gray matter, yeah, the white matter of the cerebellum. And you can see how there's one area here with a slight backward shift in position, which shows that it's extremely significant for telling t-squared statistics in these maps. Is it all visible left in? Sorry about that. So the other measure we commonly use, both in Trondheim and at the MNI in Montreal, is to measure the thickness of the cortex. So again, we have input data, we do the same linear registration that is just talked about, we remove the non-uniformity artifacts. Then we also classify the brain into gray matter, white matter, spinal fluid, fit a cortex to it, and measure the cortical thickness at every point in the cortex. So the process roughly looks like this. You take your brain, you classify it into white matter, gray matter, and CSF. And the way we do the classification is by using prior probability tags based on the linear registration you have to do. Basically, if you align all your brains into the same space, there's certain boxes that are going to have a very high likelihood of being gray matter after that alignment. So we take 1,000 points for each of the tissue types, white matter, gray matter, spinal fluid, and we use that to train a classifier individually for each brain, then separate the voxels out into white matter, gray matter, and spinal fluid. So this is one example here, where gray matter is in gray, white and white, and CSF and background in this case are black. Once we have that, we fit a model to the white matter surface. So we fit a deformable model. It basically looks like train wrapping the brain. That's what this video at the bottom is showing. Almost as if you're starting out with an egg, which has, in this case, only 320 polygons. And then you deform downwards onto the brain itself, always increasing the resolution of the model that you have, and decreasing the stiffness, so the amount of deformation that can actually happen, until you arrive at the outside boundary of the white matter surface first. So you can see here the model is increasing complexity. You have the interhemispheric fissure, beginning to see some of the main fissures, the larger fissures in the brain, the larger sulci, such as the superior frontal and central here. And as the deformation procedure goes on, we end up with slightly over 80,000 polygons fit onto the white matter surface. Once we have the white matter surface, we expand back out to the gray matter surface to give us a two-surface model of the brain. So this is one example from a single slice, where in, again, you have a classified image where we have, in this case, gray matter and cortical gray matter in dark gray. In white, you have subcortical gray, then white matter and spinal fluid in dark. And the two lines that you see are the surface intersection, where in green you have the where the white matter surface intersects with that particular slice of the brain, and in blue where you have the gray matter surface intersecting. So you can see that even though it's not perfect, you can look at individual points and see small errors, we do generally get a fairly good overview of where the cortical boundaries are hitting the cortex itself. So you have two brains that look like this. This is the white matter brain for this particular subject. This is the corresponding gray matter surface. Of course, given that you have two surfaces, you can measure the distance between all the points in the surface to give you a map of cortical thickness. Then we blur that with a diffusion smoothing kernel developed, or first implemented by Mu Chang, which looks like the following. We then have a smooth map of cortical thickness at 40,000 points in the brain. And then these can then be compared from subject to subject in terms of cortical thickness. You can do a similar thing with the mouse brain, but except we do a slightly different thing here. Because given that we can get such close to perfect registration when you use mice brains, what we do is we label an atlas of the mouse brain, and we deform all of the brains in a particular study towards that atlas. That's sort of cut up here. Then you can label the atlas into inside of the brain, gray matter, or cortex itself, and outside of the brain. And in this case, we also use a third boundary, which is right in the corpus callosum, which we use as a resistive boundary. So basically, once you have the boundary between inside and outside of the brain, you can solve the differential equation, which is the Laplace equation, which was first used by Jones et al. In 2000 for a human brain, to give you a map of streamlines going from the inside of the brain to the outside of the brain. We can integrate across them to give you a measure of cortical thickness at every point, basically by following the length of these streamlines. Map that onto the cortex itself, and again, you can compare the thickness of the cortex at every point in the brain for a mouse in terms of absolute millimeters of cortical thickness. So to show one example of where all of these are combined in mouse studies, at least, we used a mouse model developed at the University of British Columbia by Michael Hayden et al, which is a yeast artificial chromosome knock-in. So basically 120 CAG repeats of the human Huntington gene. And Huntington's is a genetically determined disease. If you have this particular increase in the CAG repeats, you're going to get Huntington's at some point or not. So it's quite easy to get a very good mouse model, which we know is fairly accurate, unlike some other disorders where it's much harder to determine whether the mouse model you have is a good one or not. So these mice have behavioral abnormalities at 9 months of age, and histopathology has shown similar patterns to humans, which especially a striatal decrease at 9 months and 12 months. So we're interested to see is if we can see some of the same things we see with histology in these mice. We did the scans at 8 months, and there were 9 mice in each group. So we should start to see if we can see any changes before they've been seen with histology, and how well the histology and the MR measures compare. So the first thing we did was compare the measures of the striatum. So the striatum was outlined both on the one time on the MR atlas and individually on the different histology slices taken from these same mice, or at least from 12 of the same mice. Then for the MR atlas, we did the whole deformation procedure where we reversed the deformation, mapped the striatum back onto each mouse, and compared the volume. And in MR, you did the stereology counting measures by integrating across the area of the different slices where you had the striatum outlined. And here's the toolbox of whiskers plots comparing them, where you have a decrease in the amount of volume of the striatum, both in sheets seen on stereology and MRI. And if you do an RC curve, you can see that there's slightly better discrimination between the mice in the two different groups, so the Huntington mouse and the normal mice, on MRI rather than stereology. So in this case, the area under the curve was 0.8 for MR and 0.7 for stereology. So we can see the same thing. We can see it slightly more significantly using MR than stereology. Actually, in this case, it was significant using the MR measures, not quite significant using stereology. But of course, one of the things you can do with MR, which you can't do as easily with stereology, is try to get more sense of the shape, how the shape of the striatum is changing. What we did is, rather than just using the deformations the way that we had them, the way I described them before, we also had to look at how the surface of the striatum itself is changing. So we did is we created a surface model just using a Marching Cubes algorithm on the labeled striatum. And then at every vertex of that model, we took the dot product between the surface normal, seen here, as well as the 3D deformation vector, to see is how much that particular voxel is moving inwards or outwards on the striatum, and compare that between the two different groups. And again, there seemed to be some significant changes, even though they were subtle. But large areas here in the frontal part of the striatum, as well as in the lateral part, are moving inwards in the Huntington mice, but not in the normal group. And these are actually significant, or at least at 5% false discovery rate significant, both in the superior and the lateral parts of the striatum. So not only can we say that there is some volume difference, we're going to begin to look at where these changes are starting to happen in these particular mice. And of course, you can do the, I don't know why these images aren't visible, sorry about that. We can do the analyses at every point in the brain, try to see if there's any voxel differences. And in this case, there were, especially in the striatum, of course, as well as some in the cortex, but seemed to actually be an increase in the amount of tissue in the cortex, and decrease some of the white matter tracts. So if we look at the cortical thickness maps between these groups, we can see this increase in cortical thickness in the Huntington mice, where this is the secondary sensory motor cortex here. So it's slightly stronger on the right, but it's somewhat bilateral, where you have this increase. So one thing which we're hypothesizing is that the striatum, which is also quite involved in motor control, is beginning to decline in these mice, and it's going to keep declining according to histology. It's possible that this increase in the thickness of the cortex in the secondary motor cortex is a compensatory response to the loss that you begin to have in the striatum itself. Then I'm going to switch topic to some purely human studies of Alzheimer's disease and look at more how we can use cortical thickness in this type of data. So Alzheimer's disease, of course, is an age-related disease really marked by neuropathological features and brain atrophy. So it's very stereotyped. Once you begin to get it, the first areas of the brain that are failing are the parahippocampal region, followed by the hippocampal region, and usually follows the same pattern of decline for everybody who has the disease. So in this case, we had patients with probable Alzheimer's disease that were taken from Vitafos by Munich. And we had 32 scans, some amount of cross-sectional data, longitudinal data in the Alzheimer's patient, and 17 controls. So this is what the differences look like on a per vertex level. This is first by group, so whether they were diagnosed Alzheimer's or not, there's multiple areas of significant differences in cortical thickness between the patients and the controls. And there's some correlation between the mini mental state exam score, which is a fairly coarse behavioral assessment of Alzheimer's patient or any dementia patient, where a declining score means that there's decreasing mental abilities. And also some fairly strong areas of associated with progression. So as the patients have Alzheimer's disease and as they begin to get worse during the disease course, areas of cortex are declining significantly in the amount of gray matter there is. And this can be well summarized by these two videos here. They show the same thing. What you have here is the absolute cortical thickness and the relative change in cortical thickness. Videos I should start playing, if they ever will. You can see the year of change it's becoming really skippy. Anyway, there's a, especially in the intraranial cortex, the parapocampal region, there's a fairly strong decrease over these 4 years that we followed these patients, where it was almost 1.5 millimeters of cortical thickness out of a starting point of about 4.5 millimeters, just in 4 years of progression of the disease. So it really is quite severe.
Why do you have so much red at 4.5 millimeters?
Why do we have so much red? I'm not sure I understand.
Well, red is 4.5 millimeters.
Yeah, well, in this case it was around 4 or higher.
And that's cortical.
Cortical thickness.
Yeah. So.
I mean, the cortex in the inferior part of the brain is one of the, especially in the temporal poles, one of the thicker areas of the brain. So it's not that abnormal for even elderly subjects to have. In this area, yes.
Probably goes back to how they measure cortical thickness. Maybe we can ask you, how do you measure cortical thickness?
In this case, we use the what we call the link distance between the white matter surface and the gray matter surface. You expand from white to gray.
I mean, the thinnest part of the cortex is accessible is about 1.5 millimeters.
No, we see this the thickest around five and a half.
You see 5 millimeters?
Yeah.
That's the cortical sheet, the 5 millimeters. And you see that in your MRI studies.
Yes.
And you've also seen that in agreement with pathology and other studies?
I mean, if you look at pathology, if you look at the studies by Von Economo,
yeah,
they go up to 4.5 millimeters of cortical thickness. So we do find the cortex to be slightly thicker. I don't entirely know whether that's a matter of algorithm. One of the things I did do, which I don't have the slides here to talk about, is compare different ways of measuring cortical thickness. And they can actually provide quite a amount of variance in terms of how you decide the measurement should be. If you just take the nearest point from one surface to the next, you get a quite a bit thinner measure than if you take a point along the surface normal, for example. But generally, even though the absolute numbers don't always agree with what the histopathology will tell you, the relative distribution usually agrees considerably, i.e. the thickest part of the cortex is the temporal pole and some of the frontal areas, the thinnest is the sensory motor and visual.
In your diagram, it wasn't like there was a little bit at the 4.5 boundary. There was a lot. I mean, your whole frontal areas were all at that sort of maximum boundary. The whole upper part, you know.
Right, and if you, I mean, this is from 0 to 4.5.
Right.
So even these areas here in red, this is going to be in the 3-point-something millimeters.
Okay.
So I think it's part of the artifact of the color scale too.
Just changed, but there, I mean, there's a lot of surface area that's like, you know, I don't know, it's changing, it's hard to see. But, okay, but anyway, in your studies, you see significant amount of surface area when you're at greater than 4 millimeters.
Yes. So the next thing we tried to do with this data was look at whether we can use the cortical thickness data to discriminate between the Alzheimer's patients and the normal controls. So the goal was to use nothing but the cortical thickness information to produce the clinical diagnosis. So note that this is not a post-mortem confirmed diagnosis, so there could be some error in the clinical diagnosis to begin with. And we use a discriminant function at each point and compute the sensitivity and specificity at each point of the cortex. In this case, sensitivity is the prediction of Alzheimer's disease given the diagnosis was AD, specificity control given diagnosis of control. So you can tell that different parts of the brain have different amounts of sensitivity and specificity, where the highest amount of sensitivity you see, highest sensitivity and specificity is really in the parahippocampal regions of the brain, which is sort of one single point. If you just take a single point here in the right parahippocampal gyrus, the black line is the line that the linear discriminant would draw in terms of separating the two groups. So most, but not all, of the patients are below the dividing line. And this is the actual cortical thickness plot in this case, where we have between 3 and 5.5 millimeters in this case. And all of the controls in this case were above the dividing line that we had. In order to try to see if we can slightly improve the diagnosis itself, and in order to reduce the number of comparisons we had, we divided the brain into a series of anatomical areas and took the mean cortical thickness for each of these areas, and then did two structure discrimination. I used the try to use any possible combination of two structures from the cortex to see how well we could do in terms of discriminating. And the best really was by combining the right parahippocampal area and the left parahippocampal area, where these three lines are three different discriminants, so linear, quadratic, and logistic. depression. And the black points are the Alzheimer's disease patients. And the red points are the controls. We can see that there's one false positive, and the rest seems to have been well divided in this group at least. Now, of course, these are not the most advanced patients in terms of, these are somewhat advanced patients. So they already have MMSE, mean MMSE of around 22, for those of you who know what that means. So it's not like we can discriminate before neurologists can. But at least the first step, which is seeing what can you do with this data compared to neurologists, seems to hold up pretty well.
Yeah, but that one person that I was about, you haven't controlled for comorbidity in either of the patients or the controls in this case. So for other diseases, that could also cause the cortical event.
Well, I mean, there was the neurologists who screened the patients did try to rule out any comorbidity. So there were no large lesions, there were no other potential causes for this. So of course, these are not postmortem. It's possible that this one control here might develop Alzheimer's in 2 years. We can't rule that out, of course.
In terms of, do you guys see your patients in terms of CDR score?
We did not have CDR in these patients.
Okay, so you don't know if these are, you know, 1 or 0.5 or 1.5, so you don't know what range, because I don't know.
They'd be between 0.5 and 1, slightly more towards the 1 area. So I think they were very slightly more, fairly close to what you were just showing before, but slightly more severe. But that's a bit of a guess, given that there's no perfect mapping between the minimal state and CDR scores. So in this case, we had one vertex out of the 40,000, which had the ability to discriminate perfectly between patients' controls. And all this is done using leave one out cross-validation. So we'd always train on all but one of the patients and try to, on all but one of the subjects, classify that one subject and repeat that for all the subjects in the study. And a few vertices in the paraprogrammal gyrus had perfect specificity with only one false negative. And good prediction can also be accomplished if you start using some of this cognitive information, such as the mini mental state exam score in this study. Now, of course, something else you can do is rather than just look at the thickness of the cortex at any one point, compare that across patients and subjects, try to see how the cortical thickness varies within itself, i.e. across the brain. So this is something that Keith was addressing early on, which we somewhat facetiously named macaque, as in mapping anatomical correlations across the cerebral cortex. So the basic hypothesis is that the thickness of the cortex across associated areas will change in a correlated fashion. So it's very similar to what people are doing with functional connectivity, trying to see if there's different changes in blood flow that correlate with one another across time, but using it in cross-sectional data with cortical thickness in this case. So this correlate hypothesis to this, of course, would be that these correlations between different brain areas can be influenced by developmental patterns, cognitive factors, whatever else. So the first measure we use is simple correlation. So as one part of the cortex changes in thickness, does another part of the cortex feature any correlated change? Well, this should be measured using Pearson's R. Another one is trying to measure the total correlation strength. So if you take every point in the cortex and correlate it with every other point, then sum the correlations. Which areas in the brain have the most amount of correlations with others, or the highest correlations with other regions, i.e. which ones are the most connected, probably, or at least the most correlated parts of the brain. Well, the hypothesis would be that this would really be the association cortices, which you expect to have the strongest amount of connections between them. And then lastly, you can look at group differences, such as the direction of correlation different between two groups in two areas, or is the variance of the correlation different. So for the actual study sample that we used, these were normal developmental subjects from the NIMH environment. We used 292 scans, entirely cross-sectional, entirely normal control. And they're between the age of 5 and 20, most of them around 8 to 14. So the first map is the map of correlation strength. And you really can see that the most correlated areas, which are in red, are the association cortices, and the least correlated are the primary motor cortices. There are some exceptions to this, but for example, if you look at the motor area and the sensory motor area, there's very little cross-correlation. And if you look at Broca's region here, for example, you can see it's very strongly correlated. If you look at the cingulate, it's actually the most correlated part of the brain with other regions there. The main exception being the temporal poles, which aren't quite as correlated with the rest of the brain as we thought.
Is that just happening average? Like, is this the strength of the average correlation for those seeds everywhere, or
yes,
is this
for the seeds everywhere? So what you do is you take one point, you correlate with all the 40,000 other points, take the mean of all those correlations, move on to the next point, you do the same thing again. Then you map that to the brain.
Jason, are there any points with consistent negative correlations? Or you mentioned your mouse model, one area was damaged and there was a hypertrophy of the other. It would be interesting in disease, if anything, reacting to the disease by doing the opposite.
We have not seen it in the cortex.
Yeah.
Don't, I don't have the data here, but in the mice we've looked at the same thing, we see that between different subcortical areas and between subcortical areas and cortex. And I'm sure that must happen in some cases using just cortex as well, but I have not actually encountered it yet. So in this case, it's all positive correlations. So the next we used a seed region, which was, we took the cytoarchitectonic map of Robin Area 44 from Katal Naumann's group in Jülich, which is shown map onto the cortex here, then correlated that with the rest of the brain to see what the correlation patterns look like. And here are the results. So of course, it correlates very well with itself, which is to be expected. But then you have this interesting pattern of correlations with the rest of the frontal lobes, as well as with this lateral pathway here. And if you know the language circuit, and Robin Area 44 is strongly involved in motor control of language. This here is Heschel's gyrus, which is really important for auditory control. And here you have Wernicke's area, which is the other part, which is very strongly associated with language. So you have this correlation pattern, which is quite similar to what you'd expect just functionally. And if you look at studies from literature, which we took one case from Parker's group, where they did map the uncinate and archaeal fasciculi using diffusion transfer mapping. And just visually comparing the two, we unfortunately did not have DTI information in these particular subjects. You can see the same kind of pattern here of this horn curving around along the arcuate and uncinate fasciculi, so having a very similar pattern of how the thickness of the cortex changes in these groups to what the diffusion tensor maps would tell us are the connected areas between them. And some of these correlation areas really quite change with age in this case. So this is, again, the correlation with Robin Area 44. So if you look at the superior temporal gyrus, again, strongly involved with language. In the young kids, which are in this case less than 8.8 years, the slope of the correlation is 0.8, and then it goes up to about 1.1, which isn't significantly different. But the variance of the correlation between Robin Area 44 and the temporal gyrus decreases considerably over time. Especially if you look at the older kids, which are greater than 14 years old, they are very tightly clustered residuals. If you look at the younger ones, it's much more scattered around. Especially this two anatomically associated areas with similar functional properties correlate more during developmental time periods. Then we also divided up the groups into different IQs, where the so-called low IQ, the low was at 100, high IQ was greater than 120. And again, the correlation patterns changed somewhat. So with Robin Area 44, especially the cingulate had a much stronger correlation than in the younger IQ groups in these subjects. So the whole idea of looking at the brain as a network of regions seems to be quite a powerful way of addressing these issues compared to just looking at one individual point, because there really are some patterns that change across the brain. And that's all that I have, and thank you.